presented by the U.S. Travel Association.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. Guess what this isn't? This is not another podcast on impeachment. We've already got one of those. The Nerdcast has gone daily during the Senate impeachment trial. But as I'm sure you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on this week, this month, this year, that you Nerdcast listeners care a lot about. So for our regular weekly episode today, we are going to jump onto the campaign trail for an update on the big fight roiling the Democratic race just days before the Iowa caucuses.
20 former Vice President Joe Biden is demanding an apology from Senator Bernie Sanders for circulating what he called a doctored video misconstruing his record on Social Security.
But first, we're going to bring you a big healthcare story you might have missed amid all the campaign and impeachment news this week. A new challenge to Obamacare is winding through the federal court system, but the Supreme Court says it won't hear the case until after the 2020 election. We'll talk about what it means and why it matters. As always, a quick note, we're taping this on Thursday, January 23rd, so if anything breaking happens after that, we will talk about it next week. All right, let's jump right into that healthcare story. I have here in the studio one of Politico's healthcare reporters, Susanna Luthi. Susanna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Susanna, you wrote a story a couple of days ago about the Supreme Court's decision not to fast-track a new challenge to Obamacare. What's the quick version? What happened here?
So this was a one-sentence order that really did nothing but roiled a lot of people.
It must be nice having that kind of power.
Yes. So basically, the coalition of Democratic states led by California Attorney General Javier Becerra and joined by the House of Representatives had asked the Supreme Court to immediately intervene in a very high-stakes lawsuit to overturn Obamacare and to resolve it once and for all this term, before summer, which also means before the election. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to fast track it.
So haven't we done this already? This feels very back to the future. Like the Supreme Court largely upheld Obamacare in 2012. It was a huge story. It happened right before that presidential election, right? Before Obama was reelected. But it turns out more cases have continued to spring up through the federal court system, right?
That's right. And actually, one of the argument that the Republican states led by Texas are using to try to kill Obamacare this time is taking one part of one of those rulings by Chief Justice John Roberts, which was actually, surprisingly, teed up for him by Justice Brett Kavanaugh when he was on the appeals court. But basically, the notion that the ACA is constitutional because it's a tax. So if you remember in 2017, when the Republicans, through reconciliation, did their big tax bill, one of the things they did was eliminate but not fully strike the very unpopular individual mandate. That's the tax penalty that you have to pay if you don't opt for ACA-compliant coverage. And basically, they zeroed it out, but they didn't actually strike it. So basically, the Republican states are saying, well, there's really no tax anymore, but Congress didn't actually eliminate, they eliminated it without eliminating it. Therefore, the ACA can't stand because this was one of the ways the Affordable Care Act was going to work.
According to the previous Supreme Court ruling.
Yes.
And so this case bubbled up through Texas.
Yes. No one paid attention when shortly after, I think it was almost exactly 2 years ago now.
I think it was during a Politico holiday party, actually.
When it was struck down. But the actual lawsuit, I think, started 2 years ago. No one was paying attention. I remember I was at dinner when it happened. But yeah, Texas led a bunch of states saying, okay, now we're going to kill Obamacare this time now that there's no individual mandate penalty. Then no one was really paying attention. And then all of a sudden, when it came time for the Trump administration to weigh in, because they're the executive branch, they're supposed to defend Obamacare, all of a sudden they say, no, we're not going to defend Obamacare. In this case. And in fact, we're going to also say, the pre-existing conditions protections and the insurance regulations should go down because there's no tax penalty to force anyone to buy this coverage. So anyway, so fast forward, we get to a conservative Texas judge in a district court in Fort Worth. I was in that courtroom. There are just a handful of us there because really no one was paying attention. And during the Politico holiday party, shortly after that, his ruling comes out saying, yes, the whole thing is unconstitutional.
And then, of course, you know, higher courts put a stay on this ruling because that's a big ruling to
make,
right?
Yes, he actually did put a stay on it. He said, yes, while this all gets sorted out.
Right, right. What, pending, you know, higher court review.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So, I mean, walk us through. Obviously, there is no immediate impact right at this moment because of that stay that we just talked about. But the impact of this decision would be massive just in terms of healthcare consumers, the health insurance industry, everything having to do with healthcare.
Absolutely. I mean, the Affordable Care Act touches pretty much every aspect. It's a huge, huge bill, as we know. Lots of new agencies popped up because of it, or not lots of, but a very important one, the Innovation Center, that actually the Trump administration is using to do a lot of policy experimentation, came from the Affordable Care Act. And the healthcare industry, I mean, it was really interesting. At first, they're kind of cautious about weighing in on the petition to expedite this case in the Supreme Court because it is seen as a very political, fraught move to get this immediately before the Supreme Court. But some major industry players, all the big hospital associations asked for the Supreme Court to expedite this case and resolve it. And
because they crave certainty.
They crave,
right?
Let's just get this done with, you know, why prolong, why delay the angst?
And of course, you mentioned the political impact of all this. And I thought it was really interesting, a little counterintuitive, but I think once you think about it, it makes sense about why Democrats were the ones pushing to get this over and done with more quickly, to have the Supreme Court review it as quickly as possible. There's a big political angle there.
There is a big political angle. And as you said, it's counterintuitive. You know, we have the Republican-led states and the Trump administration who say the ACA must go, Obamacare must go, it's a terrible law. But, oh, wait, no, don't decide ultimately whether it is right now. That can wait. And it has everything to do with politics. So in 2018, obviously, you know, Democrats ran on the ACA's protections of pre-existing conditions and the Republicans' wish to rip them all away solely on the base of this lawsuit. Obviously, that was before the ruling came out, but those of us who were in the Texas courtroom when the arguments took place, it was pretty clear that, how the judge was going to go.
And also what the position of the Trump administration
was,
obviously.
Exactly. So really, the political ads wrote themselves in 2018 for Democrats, and this also, remember, followed the very unpopular repeal and replace effort that Republicans
right.
had launched in
2017. That was a large part of 2017. I could never forget it. We had to re-record so many Nerdcast episodes
because
votes kept getting canceled and rescheduled.
I think that's how I learned all the secret passageways in Capitol. gotta find Dean Heller.
But of course the upshot of a lot of that is a lot of the criticism was that Democrats were directing at Republicans and that they reprised on the campaign trail in 2018 was, you want to make all these changes to both unpopular and popular parts of the law, right? Pre-existing conditions protection
yep.
being one of the most popular ones.
Yep.
Without necessarily a set plan to replace it. And that was when we were talking about a legislative fix, a court fix where a court is coming in and potentially striking it down. By definition, does not have a replacement built in, right?
Exactly.
And so you can see the political upside in a big way there.
Absolutely.
For Democrats in 2020.
Absolutely. Yes, the case would have huge repercussions. And the other thing that, you know, people don't really want to say, but there's a solid majority right now. It's believed that Chief Justice John Roberts would again vote to uphold the ACA. But what if, you know, Trump wins re-election? What if the makeup of the court changes with more conservative judges? You know, would that change the outcome? So, yes, there is a huge kind of...
That's a great point.
Yeah. People don't want to say it, but
Right, you know. But so like the longer you wait to hear it, the more possibility it is that the makeup of the court changes.
Exactly. And so yes, I mean, I just spoke with Attorney General Becerra today. Just came from there, and he said, yeah, I mean, why delay? We know that the Supreme Court will take it eventually. Why postpone it any further? And I want to say this caveat because this is important. They haven't denied hearing the case. So,
right.
You know, we're now
they're
on the track.
Fast tracking.
Exactly. Okay. So they could hear it next term as soon as next fall. Their next term starts in October. But it wouldn't have the, you know, immediacy for the 2020 elections that I think Democratic strategists hope it will and Republican strategists hope it will not.
Got it.
And then I think the other thing is just Obamacare just doesn't seem to be going away. But with the presidential candidates, including, you know, the top runners include Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, they're not talking about the ACA quite as much. You know, they're more in favor of more broad, comprehensive structural changes, which the ACA, while it did a lot, it's not a huge overhaul of the healthcare system. So it'll be interesting to watch how that plays out along with the messaging on the ACA. Depending on who, you know, is the Democratic nominee.
Susanna, thank you so much for coming in to walk us through that. That was so interesting. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me. Anytime.
We're switching gears to the campaign trail for segment two this week because, as I said earlier, we're just about 1 week out from the Iowa caucuses.
Can't you read the excitement on my face, Scott?
Jump on or jump off. Joining us on this wild adventure ride is senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian. Charlie, welcome.
Thanks, Scott. Happy to be here as always.
All right. So, Charlie, we can see the Iowa caucuses coming up in front of us in this metaphorical car that we're in right now. The polls are close. And I want to talk about the conflict between two frontrunners that we've seen just kind of burgeoning in the past few weeks. We've been through a lot of conflict cycles this primary. There was Castro versus O'Rourke. There was Biden versus Harris. There was Warren versus Buttigieg. But the one that seems like it's going to be taking us through the first election day is Biden versus Sanders. The two frontrunners from a year ago still in position, and they're sparring over Social Security. Charlie, break it down for us. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, I think the key word that you used was conflict. It is a conflict. To me, it's almost like a slap fight between them. It's not like a war. They're not going at it with each other. They don't hate each other. It's the kind of year where Democratic voters are just not tolerating those kinds of attacks. And we see it from the results of all of the conflicts that you mentioned earlier, whether it was Julian Castro taking Beto down a peg or Kamala Harris dropping that bomb on Biden, unexpected in the debate, the Warren Buttigieg conflict, all of those produced something of maybe a sugar high for all the candidates, and that you saw in a couple of instances, the polls spiked up a little bit for the aggressor, but then they fell down, and ultimately, in many of those cases, those candidates got nowhere. So I think the lesson that a lot of candidates have taken from this is that Democratic voters really don't have an appetite, and we don't have the kind of deep-seated animosities that maybe we've seen in other primaries on both sides that sort of fuel these kinds of wars between candidates.
And I guess, to be clear, both candidates are running in their platforms this year on expanding Social Security. But what Sanders is hitting Biden over is having said in the past, I think the word is adjustments, right? There's been a lot of talk about, you know, how to control federal spending over the many, many decades that Joe Biden has been in public office, and Bernie Sanders for that matter. And that in the past, Joe Biden has shown openness to, I'm sure he would use a different word, but to, you know, capping or cutting Social Security payments.
Right, or slowing the rise, you know, slowing the pace or payroll tax cut holidays, things like that. I mean, there's lots of ways to describe these things. I think at the broadest level, what's important to know is that Biden was willing over the course of his career to whether you call them cuts, whatever you call them, he was willing to entertain proposals that could in some ways be viewed as or could have the effect of cutting Social Security, mainly in the under the auspices of budget austerity. The difference is that these kinds of ideas that Biden was willing to entertain were anathema to progressives like Bernie, who were absolutists on the issue. And that's, I think, really the heart of what's going on here. And the difference in, I think, Biden's frustration is that he believes that the way his record has been portrayed, the idea that he agreed with former House Speaker, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan, is kind of an outrage, and he's reacted really strongly to that. But to progressives like Bernie Sanders, to them, they don't really make a distinction. If you were willing to entertain cuts, then you were with Paul Ryan.
You edited a story about this a couple weeks ago that I thought was really interesting, that basically this conflict and Sanders on one side and Biden on the other side actually flared about 10 years ago and in a lot of ways led to Bernie Sanders becoming who he is now, a star of the national progressive movement, as opposed to just kind of a lonely old crank senator.
Yeah, it's a really interesting history the two have together. It's not like there's this long, bitter history together. But so I was explaining this to one of my kids the other day who has been following the presidential race and doesn't really know much about the candidates or the background. And so I always try and humanize the candidates or their disputes to get them to understand it. And the point I was making is, like, imagine the Senate is like high school. And so Biden was the quarterback at the time, before he became vice president. So he had been in there for years and years and years. He was the cool kid, the popular kid, the quarterback. And Bernie was the nerd in the back who nobody would talk to. I mean, remember when Bernie came into the Senate? It was long after Joe Biden had joined the Senate. Biden had already run for president when Bernie was like a mayor of a small city with wild white hair, entertaining all these crazy ideas. So he comes into the Senate where the establishmentarians like Biden and the high school quarterbacks, they look down on him because he's a backbencher. He's a believer. He's, Don Quixote in the backbenches who can't pass any legislation because he's an absolutist. But at the same time, they respect him as a guy with really strong beliefs. So that's the backdrop for their relationship. And then this is, obviously anything that would affect Social Security is something of great concern to Bernie Sanders. He drew a hard, sharp line on this and was very effective in, I think, publicizing his position in saying this is, this was his you shall not pass moment. And
it was regarding a last minute spending package that was negotiated between like Senate Republicans and the White House, which was represented by Biden was representing the Obama administration, right, in at the very end of 2010, and there was a payroll tax cut that was being mooted as part of this, and Sanders saw this as just like a no-go.
So we're talking about December 2010 at that point, and Biden has left the Senate, and this was when Bernie filibustered the Biden negotiated deal with Republicans that extended Bush era tax cuts, cut the estate tax, and created a temporary Social Security payroll tax cut, or what some people called a tax holiday. And keep in mind the political context, because this would have been very important to Joe Biden and Barack Obama at the time. This was right after the November midterm elections, where Democrats got killed at the polls. So they're feeling like they're in a very precarious position. Biden and Obama are leading this party that just got destroyed at the polls, and so they need to show that they're reasonable centrists and they're serious about deficit reduction. But you can imagine Bernie's response. He doesn't care. He doesn't care that the National Party just got killed because he's from Vermont. Nobody got killed in Vermont. So the political implications of what had just happened were not as strong to him. And as an absolutist, he did not want to entertain any of it. And the best part of that, we had a quote in the story, and it was a really interesting story by Mark Caputo, who covers Joe Biden for us. And I still remember the quote, which was from a senior advisor to Sanders, who said, after Biden, he describes how Biden briefs the Democratic caucus about the plan, and Sanders' advisor tells Mark, you can see Bernie sitting there listening to that and his blood starting to boil.
And of course, so he gives this filibuster. The filibuster they actually end up publishing as a book. And the folks around Sanders feel like this is what launched him on the pathway to eventually running for president in 2016, obviously became a huge star, now running for president again in 2020. And here he and Joe Biden are again litigating this argument with just days to go before the Iowa caucuses. I do think it's interesting, as you brought up at the beginning, Charlie, that, you know, despite the conflict between them, there has not been a single negative TV ad in the Democratic primary yet. And you know, we've got, what, 10, 11, not very many days left until the Iowa caucuses. I'm sure it'll still happen at some point. But I think that speaks to how close and tightly packed things are.
Yeah, and it's also the slap fight aspect of it. And keep in mind, all the politicians that are in this in the Democratic primary that are still left, the top tier candidates, they didn't – their reputations aren't built on being sharp-elbowed attackers. They're not attack dogs. They did not get to where they were by going to war with their opponents the whole time, whether it was Bernie in Vermont or whether it was Biden in Delaware. Same thing with Elizabeth Warren. These are folks that didn't have the kind of the kind of bare knuckled fights that many other senators have gone through to forge their political persona. So there's that. They also know that Democrats in the Trump era do not want to deal with any Democratic on Democratic violence, and I think they want to project a more positive message through their television advertising.
Yeah, those are all great points, Charlie. I agree with all of them. There's something else I've been thinking about recently too, which is that, you know, we're 16 years on now from the 2004 presidential race. You've got a ton of strategists and operatives working in all these campaigns who maybe they had their first job, or that was the first campaign, presidential campaign they really paid attention to, or, you know, their political awakening came. And watching the two front runners in Iowa, Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt, absolutely destroy each other and then get surpassed by the other two main candidates, John Kerry, of course, who won the nomination, and John Edwards.
In 2004.
I wonder if that has just scarred everyone mentally, and the ghosts of that are looming over everyone who's making these decisions, who'd be in a position to run a negative ad, you know, heading into Iowa at least. And they can't stop thinking about how both of those guys plummeted and let someone else come in and take the nomination.
I love that theory. I want to steal it and put it in the story.
Well, Charlie, thanks for joining us to walk us through it. You're going to Iowa soon, right, for the stretch run?
I am.
What are you looking forward to most? The weather?
The flatness. No, I'm just kidding. I actually love Iowa. Yeah. Iowa's fantastic. It's so underrated. I love Des Moines. And I'm not even kidding. Like, I love going there. I've been there a million times, and it's always great. The people take it so seriously. It's just super cool how seriously they take their civic responsibility. And like the pork the pork products are just amazing. Like, you can get pork anything, and it's all outstanding. It's just I'm a huge fan of Iowa. I'm going to be there for a week, but I'm just really looking forward to it.
Excellent. All right. Well, have a good time on the trail.
Thanks.
And as always, a big thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in. All right. That's our show this week. Our producer for this episode is Annie Reese. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. And our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thanks for tuning in. We'll talk again next week.